I'm an alcoholic, and my name is Tom Brady, Jr. Hi, everybody. And by the grace of God, which has come to me through my attempts to work the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't had the compulsion to drink since July 20th of 1965. This still amazes me. And what you see before you tonight, and this is even more amazing, is the same equipment that walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous 12 years, 8 months, and 25 days ago. I count. I have the same arms, the same legs, same brain, put on a little poundage as I get older. But basically, I've got the same equipment that came through the doors that long ago. And something has radically changed. Same equipment, different person. Same equipment, different values, different priorities, different interests. You see, I found a new world through this program. It's a world that we call the world of the spirit down south. When she introduced me tonight, Janet said I talk the language of the heart, and I'm glad she said that. Much of what I say to you tonight probably will not be logical. But I know through this program that there is a power that transcends all logic. If you think about it for just a moment, I'm an alcoholic and I'm sober. That's not logical. If you're an alcoholic and you're sober and you've been sober 124 hours, that is fantastic, because it's not supposed to be. It's illogical, unreasonable, and cannot be understood with the intellect. But you see, in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned, too, that the world of intellect is not necessarily the real world. I feel like sometimes I live in two different worlds. The one world is the world of the ego. It's the world where everybody's an individual and unique and separate. It's a getting world. It's a world where everything is organized and stilted and rigid and inflexible. The world of separation. And there's the other world, the world of the spirit. And this is the world where we no longer say I in the sense that we said I before. When we say I in this world of Alcoholics Anonymous, we mean we. This is a we world. It's a world of relation. It's a world of giving. It's a world more than anything else where our differences dissolve and our similarities come together and save our lives. So I'm not going to talk to you about things like drinking patterns, who you are, how much money you have, your education, your lack of education, your status, your profession. I'd waste all my time tonight trying to identify with you on this basis. And really, I think what we have different about ourselves is irrelevant to my alcoholism. What keeps me sober in this program is what the big book says. We have a common problem to which we have found a common solution. Be you doctor, lawyer, merchant, chief, black, white, woman, man, young, old, makes no difference. We have a common problem to which we have found a common solution. And that, to me, is the basis of the unity of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm going to speak to you about funny things. I'm going to speak to you about the things that we have in common. Now, I don't know about you, and I say that tongue-in-cheek because I do, if you're an alcoholic, know about you. I believe that once we get beyond names, drinking patterns, age, sex, race, creed, color, profession, and all the things that I mentioned, and get down to what's really important about alcoholism, every alcoholic on the face of God's earth is 95% alike once you take away those differences. I know a lady down in Georgia who says, honey, tell me your name and I'll tell you the rest. And I thoroughly believe this. I thoroughly believe this from experience. From experience. So basically what I'll talk to you about tonight is my feelings. I'm a creature of feeling. I've never met an alcoholic who was not a creature of feeling. And there I can identify, because I've felt what you felt, and I've thought what you thought, and I've done what you've done. I'm going to talk, too, as I always do, about two basic things. I'm going to talk about powerlessness, and I'm going to talk about power. I'm going to talk about myself, and I'm going to talk about God as I understand it. Because my very life depends on the recognition of which is which. That's where it's at. That's where the principle of anonymity in this program looms large to me. Because anonymity, basically, to me, is knowing who has the power and who doesn't. Anonymity, basically, to me, is not a band-aid that hides a sore spot. Anonymity, to me, says out loud, it is not who I am that matters. It's what I am. And more importantly, what God is. So I'm going to talk about those strange, funny, illogical things. Because, you see, the world of the Spirit, to me, is the real world. If there's something realer than real, the world that I've found in Alcoholics Anonymous is it. Because it's truth with a capital T. Most of you people know Len B. I wonder if you know that he went to a psychiatrist once and poured out his soul to the psychiatrist, and when he got done, the psychiatrist, he said, "What is your opinion, doctor?" And the doctor says, "Len, my opinion, from what you've told me thus far, is that you're completely crazy." And Len was rather incensed by this, and he said, "Well, I'd like a second opinion." He said, "Okay, Len, you're ugly as hell, too." And I got to tell you my story. This is a story I've told in every talk I've ever made. Makes me feel comfortable, and I'm nervous. Awfully nervous. I want to go to the bathroom real bad. And by the way, if any of you came to Alcoholics Anonymous for your bladder, forget it. With all the coffee we drink, the bladder problem always gets worse. And let me say one more thing before I get into this. I'm an alcoholic, and basically I'm talking to alcoholics. But I've found that alcoholics are not that different. Our outstanding attribute, the thing that sets us apart from the other people of the world who have problems, is that we're allergic to alcohol. That's about it. I've had many an Al-Anon come up to me after I talk and said, "I felt like you felt." I said, "I know you felt like I felt. We're not that different." So I put it this way, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm speaking basically to alcoholics, and the rest of you folks can listen, too, if you want to. But I got to tell you this story. It's about a little guy who lives down in North Carolina, and we have a section of the state that we call the Sand Hills. And it's flat, sandy land, just as far as you can see, and it's literally covered with longleaf pine trees. That's all there is, sand and pine trees. And there was this little kid who lived down there in the Sand Hills, and every day he'd go out in that flat pine forest and he'd be playing. And every day when the sun would start going down, the little kid would realize he was lost. Well, there's no way to shimmy up a longleaf pine to find your way home. So every day they'd have to send out a search party to find this little boy. And they sent out time after time and brought him home. And his mother told him one night, "The next time you're lost out in the woods, get out on your knees and ask God to show you the way out, and he'll do it." So the little boy's out in the woods the next day. He's playing happily along, you know, and the sun starts going down, and he realizes deep down where we realize things, "Oh, God, I'm lost." But he remembered what his mother said, and he got down on his knees and very reverently said, "Lord, I'm lost, and I want you to show me by some sign how to get out of here. Amen." And he got up, and he held his hand out here, and nothing happened, and he held it out here, and nothing happened, and held it out here and nothing happened. And he held it out front and a little bird flew over and dropped one right in his hand. And he contemplated it, shook it off, got back down on his knees and very reverently said, "Lord, Don't hand me no crap. I'm really lost. And the reason I like this story is that it reminds me of me so much. How many times did I ask God for a signal, and how many times did he respond? Every time. What I didn't like was the way he sent me the message. I never agreed with it. I never agreed with the way he did things. He just wasn't doing things right. There's another story I'll tell you. This is a true story. About this young man that I sponsored in Alcoholics Anonymous. His name was Doug, and he worked with a huge rubber company in the state. And after about 3 months of sobriety, they called him down to Atlanta, Georgia, to the regional office. And Doug was a little worried, only 3 months sober, and he wanted his sponsor to go with him. He was afraid he was going to get fired or chewed out. And so we got on an airplane. We went down to Atlanta. He went to the office, and there was nothing but pats on the back for Doug because he'd been sober for 3 months and been doing his job for the first time since he'd been with the company. And they were very high on him. And we were both very happy, and we went out to the airport in Atlanta, Georgia. And we were standing up at this table having a hot dog and a cup of coffee. I don't know about you other fellas in my generation, but I've never gotten used to the braless look. That doesn't mean I don't like it. I'm just not used to it. And along the hall of the Atlanta, Georgia airport came the most braless woman I have ever seen in my life. And Doug and I transfixed our eyes upon her. I can't lie to you. We really, you know, sing. And we watched her, and when the front went by, the back was so nice, we started watching that too. And when she was completely out of sight, Doug turns around to me and he said, "Tom, that woman sure did remind me of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "How, man?" He said, "She's self-supporting through her own contribution." And you know, I had to agree with him. I've got to tell you, too, before I really get into it, that as well as being, I have a dual problem. As well as being an alcoholic, I'm a Southern Baptist. I used to say I suffered from two diseases, baptism and alcoholism. By the grace of God, I was recovering from both. But I am a Baptist. I don't go to church. But when you're trained as a Baptist, you're a Baptist. And an old-timer in AA told me one time, "Tom, quit trying to stop being a Baptist. It's in you. It's always going to be in you." Now, when I get enthusiastic about things, I have a tendency to preach me a sermon. So if I preach you a sermon tonight, I make no excuses for it. It's my Baptist background. My mother just retired recently as a hostess of one of the largest Baptist churches in the state of North Carolina. My father, who died in January, was on the board of deacons in the Baptist church for 55 years and led the singing in 3 Sunday school classes and taught 2 more. Very religious people and good people. The salt of the earth. So if I talk to you about that, it's because I was brought up in that Baptist church. And you know a strange thing? Some of the values that I learned as a child today have meaning. Deep meaning. All right, let's get down to it. I'm an alcoholic, and I have a personality which demands answers. I've always had a personality which demanded answers, not halfway answers. You don't get away with giving an alcoholic a halfway answer. It has got to be big, and it's got to mean something, and it's got to settle in here so that he can say, "Yeah, yeah." So he can say, "It feels good. It feels right." I wanted an answer. From my earliest memories, I had to have it. It wasn't good enough for me to read a page out of a book. That was deadly. I had to read the whole book and read it quick. And I searched and I searched and I searched for all of my life. And as far back as I can remember, I was afraid. I read a book by a psychologist once in which he listed 206 different phobias. And I got to the end of the list, and of course, phobia is the Greek word for fear. And I'd had all 206 fears. And I sat there and thought about it a little bit, looking for that answer, and I said, no, that's not all. There's one more fear. Fear number 207. The fear that every alcoholic on God's earth has felt and probably will feel again. The fear that's referred to in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous as the fear of impending calamity. There's no fear like it. Even our friends, the psychiatrists, we can call them friends, can't we? Have a special word for this. They call it free-floating anxiety. And man, I say, that ain't heavy enough. When they experience it, they'll change the name of it. Free-floating anxiety doesn't fit. It's a gut fear. And with me, it went like this. Oh, my God. I don't know what's going to happen to me. I don't know where, when, why, or who's going to do it. But something's going to happen to me, and it's going to be bad. And I walked around with this fear all of my life. Not just after I started drinking, Keith. All of my life I had this fear in my gut. Seemed like when all the other fears would disappear and everything was good, all of a sudden, bam! Oh, my God. And that's the worst feeling in this world. That kind of fear is the worst. It was to me. I look back on my life and I had a lot to be afraid about. That I can laugh at now. I couldn't then. You see, I was the ugliest baby you have ever seen. My own mother told me she had never seen an ugly baby until I was born. And she wouldn't take me out of the house the first 6 weeks I was on the face of the earth. And talking to a psychiatrist one time, he said, it must have hurt you for your mama to tell you that. I said, no, sir, it didn't hurt a bit. I've seen my baby picture. And as I grew up, I grew this great shock of snow-white hair. And all of my big macho uncles called me Cotton Top and Puddin' Head, you know. Now, that just doesn't fit a manly image. Even when I was 18 years old, everybody called me Sweet Lips. But I was a Cotton Top, beautiful snow-white hair, you know. And I had freckles. I had freckles from the top of my head to the bottom of my feet. I had freckles where you're not supposed to have freckles. But I can testify to you that you can have them there. And I was skinny. People have written books, Sobriety and Beyond. I got a friend said he's going to write one called Humility and Beyond. I said, good, I'll write the sequel, Ugly and Beyond. And I was skinny. I was one of those kids that was so skinny when I turned sideways, my shoulder blade stuck out, and I looked like you could jump on and ride off, just like a tricycle. Now, let me qualify this. I've looked back at my pictures when I was a kid, and I wasn't ugly. I was a nice-looking little kid. However, the important thing was I felt I was ugly. I felt it, and I felt it strongly. Now, it wasn't enough that I was skinny, but my mother loved knickers. Brown corduroy knickers. Any of you guys ever had to wear knickers? It wasn't enough that you swished when you walked. You know, people already called me Puddinhead, and here I was swishing down the hall at school. You go up to the blackboard, you reach up to write something, and that left leg would fall down. You had to pull it up, you know. When you got legs this big and knicker holes that big, you ain't going to wear knickers. I was forever pulling up those knickers. You know, and I'd hide them, I'd throw them away, I'd lose them. My mother would go up to Steinberg's department store and get me another pair. Always brown corduroy knickers. When I went to the Baptist church, which was quite often, I had a little blue cap I had to wear on the back of my snow-white hat. I accused my mother today of making me wear a yarmulke to church, and I ain't even Jewish. And we laugh about it now. And I threw that away, and she'd buy me a new one. But the main thing that bothered me was the freckles. And I used to lay in the bed and think, man, oh, man, if I can ever get rid of these freckles, everything's going to be all right. And you know, I did, long about the age of 12 or 13, is replaced with the most beautiful set of pimples you ever saw in your life. Now, my mom and dad were from the old school. They always told me, Tommy, if you do certain things, you're going to have pimples on your face. And I used to say, I didn't do any of those things. But I was good at it. I really had a natural talent for it, I'm telling you. Ambidextrous. Man, I lived in fantasy land before Disney ever thought of building the place. And you know, as much as I would deny it, I'd walk down the street, and it was like I had a neon sign over my head. All people had to do was look at my face, you know, and see them pimples, and it was like that sign was saying, he's doing it, he's doing it, he's doing it, he's doing it. And, you know, that didn't help my fear at all. A new kind of fear entered my life about this time. And the fear went this way. Everyone's staring at me. Everyone's talking about me. And the worst part of all, they know what I'm doing. And I started living with that fear. And that's something else. That is really something else. I've always felt different. You ever feel different? I always felt like I was outside. I always felt I never was a part of anything. You know, other kids didn't feel this way. I did. I was different. I was outside. I was a part. I tried to get in. Even when I was in, I didn't feel like I was in. Later on in my drinking, many times I'd go into a crowded bar, but I was absolutely alone. Do you know what I mean? Absolutely alone, different, apart, set aside. And God, I had to find some way to get into life. I had to be a part of it. And then is when I entered into my insanity, Keith. Then is when my mind started saying to me, I can be a part of that. I will be a part of that. I must be a part of that. And I'll do it on my own. I'll manipulate, I'll use, I'll con, I'll do anything I can do, but by damn, I'm getting in. I am sick of being different. And I became what I know as a perfectionist. Call it an extremist, like the book does, or egocentric, self-centered person, like the book does, if you wish. It's the same thing to me. I became one of those guys who everything I did it better and quicker than anybody else had ever done it. Why? Because momentarily, you'd come to me and you'd say, man, you're smart. Man, you're good. I like you. I approve of you. You're in. When you got nothing going on the inside, everything has to come from the outside. And I went after it. And I went after it with a drive and an obsession that you wouldn't believe. Every task I ever did, I ended up in first place. I had to have the spotlight, the top of the heap, never second place, never third. I couldn't stand it. If I found out I couldn't get to the top, I'd sneak away so you wouldn't know it. I never allowed myself to make a mistake. I never allowed you to make a mistake. When you didn't live up to my standards for you, I hated you. And when I didn't live up to my standards for me, I hated me. And what I didn't realize was that these were impossible standards. And as a perfectionist, I was always comparing. Always comparing. And the funny thing about comparing, I always came up too high or too low. Every perfectionist in the world is doomed until he realizes what he's doing to his own self. I always wanted to, I was supposed to be so-and-so. I ought to be so-and-so. I will be so-and-so. Never did I like who I was, where I was, what I was doing, and who I was with. I found out a strange thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is that by being what I am, I'm becoming what I always thought I ought to be. Not the other way around. I'm all I got. And I like me. perfectionistic drive. I was always too happy or too bad. Always up or down. Never in between. No balance. No peace of mind. No peace at all. I was either flitting around humming tunes, you know, or dragging my butt. I was diagnosed as a manic depressive once. I buy it. The book talks about the manic depressive type of alcoholic, about which a whole book could be written. I agree with that. That's the kind of person I was, a yo-yo. Up and down and up and down and up and down. Hanging on somebody's string, always hanging on somebody else's string. They pulled, I came up. They let go, I went down. And not realizing the whole time that I was trying to satisfy that part of myself which is completely insatiable, namely the human ego. I was different. As a perfectionist in the Baptist Church, there was a group of boys in the Baptist Church called the Royal Ambassadors for Christ. Any RAs out there anywhere? The highest rank in the Royal Ambassadors was Ambassador Plenipotentiary. I couldn't even say the word, but I was one quicker than anybody had ever been one before. They put me in front of the Tabernacle Baptist Church, 2,000 people, and had me recite memory verses and put the spotlight on me. I'd recite memory verses you wanted to hear, memory verses you'd never heard, and I'd recite them when you didn't want to hear them. Just mash my button, and I'd recite them. A funny thing about me as a perfectionist, I understand it today, you know. Everybody would come up and they patted me on the back. Hey, you smart. Hey, you good boy. Everybody was satisfied with me but one person. Me. Every time I ever saw something, went after it, and got it, I'd say something to myself like, so what? What's next? So what? What's next? When I was 17 years old, I borrowed a bass fiddle from the band director at the high school, and I practiced bass fiddle for 2 solid weeks. Like to drove my mom and daddy crazy, practicing plunking on that bull fiddle 12 and 14 hours a day. But at the end of 2 weeks, I was playing with one of the best college dance bands in the state of North Carolina. That's what a perfectionist will do. And while I was playing, I was saying, so what? What's next? Now, as well as these other things, I'm an extremely sensitive individual. I almost hate to bring this up, but alcoholics are extremely sensitive people. I was one of those guys that walked around with my feelings sticking out 50 yards in all directions, and God help you if you stepped on them. But you know what I did? When no one stepped on them, I'd go find somebody to hurt my feelings. I think they call that leading with the chin. And I live my life this way, running around saying to the world, hurt me, I deserve it, I'm no damn good, I'm different, I'm outside. And dissatisfaction with myself started turning into a deep dislike of myself. And by the time I came through the doors of this program, I hated my guts. And if any of you are working on that fourth step in Alcoholics Anonymous, that personal inventory, take a look at the self-hate. Don't miss it. Don't miss it. Every perfectionist hates his guts. Sensitive. I got a friend in California who says, people who don't know how sensitive alcoholics are say that we're immature. He says, for instance, a psychiatrist could walk in the room and there you are, drunk on the floor, looking out the picture window, crying over a beautiful sunset. Have you done it? Crying because it's so beautiful, you just can't hardly stand it. And the psychiatrist will point at you and say, he's immature. See, he's not immature. He said, that damn shrink just can't see how pretty it is. And he goes on to say, alcoholics have 10 times the capacity for feeling of a normal human being. And I believe that. Extreme sensitivity. And we live with it. I live with it today. For a long time, I had a hard time with that people are staring at me, people are looking at me kind of thing. Because I always felt something was wrong with me. As I've grown in this program and seen more and more right about me, It's nothing that people turn and stare at me now. Like one of my lady faculty members at the college where I worked, you know. People turn around and look at me when I walk in a restaurant. And I go checking my fly. Something got to be wrong. She said, what are you doing? I said, is anything open? She said, no. She said, Tom, you're a good-looking man. People turn around and look at you. She told me that, a civilian, a normsy. Sensitivity is a heck of a thing to live with. As well as being these other things, you may not know it, but you're looking at one of the smartest men you have ever seen in your life. One of the things I excelled at was being smart. I never made below an A in school until I was 15 years old. Then I took my first drink and school was out. When I graduated college, I graduated with honors, 3.94 average out of a possible 4, majors in philosophy and history, minors in religion, Greek, and English. Elected to who's who among students in American universities and colleges my junior and senior year, every honor society they had, outstanding biblical student, 1961-62, how about that for a drunk? Sang with the alumni quartet, was a soloist with the college choir, had so many scholarships when I graduated college, they owed me $16. Now I can take you to my home and I can show you pictures of me in my college annuals. Not small pictures, big pictures, half-page pictures. Up above says, who's who? Down below gives you my pedigree, telling you just how smart I really am, you know. But the beautiful thing is the picture in between. There sits Mr. Arrogant, who when they took the picture the first year was so drunk he was about to fall out of that chair, and when they took it the second year was so hungover he was about to shake out of the chair. Appearances. Appearances. Facade. Pretending to be something that I wasn't, and God knows I wanted to be it, but I wasn't. And I conned everybody in the world except that one person, and that was me. And the self-dislike went on down into self-hate. And the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, says, every alcoholic is very much the actor. There's his stage character he presents to the world. And there's his inner self that he hopes will never see the light of day. And the deepest form of dishonesty in which I ever participated in my entire life, Keith, was the deception of myself. Pretending to be what I was not with me. That's the reason I think this program demands rigorous honesty of Tom with Tom. And it follows you'll be honest with everybody else. But first and foremost, you got to quit conning number one. But I was very much the actor. And again, people patted me on the back. Made 117 on a biology exam one time. Highest you could make is 100. The other kids come and pat me on the back and say, man, you're smart. Man, you're brilliant, you know. I made excuse for not doing better. You hear me? Sing with the college choir and people come up and say, hey, man, that was beautiful. You did a real good job. Well, I'd have done better if it hadn't been for my throat. I could not accept a compliment. That's another thing about the sensitivity of the alcoholic. Criticism? No. Compliments? No. I couldn't handle either one. Neither. And I was a mess. Now, I firmly believe today that the very characteristics that I've talked to you about that made me such a sick person today are giving me an abundant life. They've been changed. Not one cubit's been added to my stature. Not one. Same equipment. But somehow, in the higher power's hands, the things that were my gravest weaknesses are becoming my greatest strength. And the things that were my greatest liabilities are becoming my greatest assets. Don't ask me how. I don't care. I'm no theologian. I'm a grateful recipient of God's grace. How he does it is his business. I'm just damn glad he does. Now, when I was 15 years old, I was on a singing trip in a hotel in Greensboro, North Carolina. The name of the hotel was the King Cotton. We were on the 14th floor. I can picture it as if it were yesterday. And here I was, fearful, sensitive, pretending, being different, outside, scared to death. And the guys I were with were guys of older, more practiced experience. They were 17 and 18 years old. And one in particular I always looked up to. His name was Clifton Baker, and we called him Egghead. Now, there's an Egghead Baker in everybody's life. Egghead's the guy that would start the fight, and he'd disappear while you got whooped. You know the type I'm talking about? But I thought Egghead was wise at this period of time. And these guys sent a cab driver out. They gave him $7.50, and he came back in a little bit, and he had a pint of brown fluid in his hand, and a label on it said Cream of Kentucky. I'll never forget it. I said to Egghead, what do we do with this? He said, we drink it. I said, how do we drink it? He said, Tom, you take a water glass full and you drink it down as fast as you can. Then you take a glass full of water and drink that down as fast as you can. After a while, you're going to feel pretty good. Well, I went into the bathroom and stood in front of the mirror and watched myself take my first drink. You know what happened? It hit. I wasn't sensitive anymore. I was where I wanted to be. I was who I wanted to be with. I was what I wanted to be. I was absolutely comfortable. For the first time in my entire life, the answer that I had sought had been found. That's why I tell people today, don't you dare take away an alcoholic's answer. Don't take away his booze unless you can replace it with a much larger substitute. You take away his booze, he'll get some pills. You take away his pills, he'll get some sex. But he'll get back to alcohol eventually. To sober up an alcoholic like me, you got to replace that answer. And the big book says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a sufficient substitute for the alcoholic. And I believe it. I believe it. I forgot to tell you, too, I'm also a very romantic person. I don't want to miss this because I said I had a dual problem. Really, it's triple. I was one of those guys who's always sitting around dreaming what he's going to be when he grew up. I used to get drunk and say to my wife, Donna, how would you like to be married to a Baptist preacher who practiced law and medicine on the side? And I loved atmosphere. I found out after I got sober, atmosphere is nothing but a nasty place with no lights. And I loved women. Man, I love beautiful women and attractive women and mediocre women, ugly women, atrocious women. I woke up with women looked like they'd been dead a year. That's one of those mornings when you wake up, you got two reasons to puke. Oh, God, what have I done? But the night before and all that atmosphere, she was one of God's loveliest children. Absolutely gorgeous. But at 15, and I'm serious, I found my answer. The book says alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. And the power of alcohol to me was just this. It gave me the thing I had been looking for all of my life. It gave me the thing that every man seeks. Because you see, with alcohol, for the first time in my life, I was free. Freedom is what it gave me. I was loose, comfortable. That's powerful. God, that's powerful. And I spent the next 15 years trying to feel that same freedom, and I never did. I never did. I became insane. I became obsessed. Why not? It's the only answer I knew. I went after it. In the face of huge obstacles, I went after it. I went after it when I had no money. If I had no money, I stole. Or a con. I was a great pretender. I could go in a bar. If you want to talk to a psychiatrist, you were talking to one. If you wanted to talk to a religious man, you were talking to one. I could be anything you wanted me to be. I never could be what I wanted to be. My wife used to be amazed. I'd go out on a four-day drunk, no money in my pocket, come back with $100 drunk. How do you do that? Because I'm a con man. Every alcoholic's a con man, and you women and men who've lived with us know damn well we're con men. I got what I wanted. And sane people have one thing in common. They all believe in a lie. Go to the back ward of your mental hospital if you don't believe me. And you'll see a guy or a gal all balled up in the fetal position. They're laughing, singing, giggling, and talking to themselves. Because they think there's no one else to talk to. And you look at them and say, there's someone else to talk to. That's a lie. He must be crazy. And the paranoid developed a system to break the bank in Las Vegas, and he thinks somebody's chasing him and trying to get his system. And we look at him and say, that's a lie. He's got no system, and nobody's chasing him and trying to get his system. He must be crazy. And what about me? Who told myself the alcoholics lie time and time again. You know what it was? This time, it's going to be different. This time, if I just handle it right, I'm going to be able to drink like everybody else. The big book says it's a great obsession of every abnormal drinker that someday, somehow, he'll be able to control and enjoy his drinking. The persistence of the illusion is astonishing. Some pursue it to the gates of insanity or even death. You've buried them. You've buried them, and so have I. Chasing that answer. And all of the time, the answer was temporary. It did not last. It was illusionary. It was not real. Came running back out in the backyard and yelled at that other kid and said, if you don't do what I want you to do and say what I want you to say, I'm going to hit you on the head with this hammer, just like this. And he just about killed himself. And when she first told me that, I said, well, that's appropriate. That's a weird bunch of people anyway, you know. And I got thinking about that. I didn't want to, but I couldn't help but think about it. And do you know I lived my whole life that way? I said to the people of the world and to the world itself, if you don't do what I want you to do and say what I want you to say, I'm going to hit you on the head with this hammer just like this. I'll get drunk at you. I'll show you. I'll kill me. Think about it. Alcoholic logic. I got a friend down in North Carolina. Somebody asked me to tell this, so I will. He's talking about alcoholic insanity. So you can take a normal man, a schizophrenic, and an alcoholic and put them in this hall tonight and say when they go out that center door, there's a man outside with a baseball bat, and when they walk through the door, he lets them have it right up beside the head with that baseball bat. He said the normal man will never go through that door again. And the skip, so he'll go through there one more time just to see if it was real, you know? Said, but the alcoholic will go through that door time after time after time after time after time, and one day he'll get there. If the man with the bat's not there, he'll sit down and wait for him. And you know the funniest thing of all? We think the rest of the world's crazy. I chased my dream. And by the time I was 23 years old, I'd had over 1,000 stitches taken in my face alone. I've been through more windshields with my head than most people have ever looked through. I've been in jail more times than I care to remember. I've been in religious homes for alcoholics, alcoholic rehabilitation centers. You name it, I was there. And I was still telling myself the alcoholic's lie. This time it's going to be different. You're different. You've always been different. Keep trying. At 23 years of age, I attended my first AA meeting. That was in Raleigh, North Carolina, which was my home at the time. And there's a fella up there now who told me after I was sober for about 3 or 4 years, I remember your first meeting, Tom. He said, you came through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I took one look at you, punched the guy next to me, and said, he ain't just an alcoholic. He's crazy as hell. It was that obvious. But, you know, I came into AA, you know, the intellectual royal ambassador for Christ with that great photographic mind. And I saw this man up at the front. And it was 12 steps on this side and 12 traditions on this side. And he was had a big book in front of him, a blue book I'd never seen before. And the big mind went to work, and it said, all you got to do is memorize that book. Memorize those steps, memorize those traditions, and they'll put you up front and they'll listen to you. You'll be on top of this outfit. You'll be president of Alcoholics Anonymous within 6 months. And I did. I memorized the book. I can quote great portions of this book to you tonight. The difference today is I don't have to. And then I did. And sure enough, they put me up front. And I delivered some of the windiest dissertations on metaphysics and theology and psychology and philosophy and various other kinds of bullshit you ever heard in your life. Let me point this out, unless you miss it. I knew this program. I knew it. Every jot and every tittle. But I couldn't say so. What does it say? Self-knowledge is not enough. I learned from hard experience that I'm trying to share with you. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a trip of the mind. It has nothing to do with what we know as intellect. Alcoholics Anonymous is very much, in essence, a program of the heart. It's a heart trip, and it has everything to do with what we refer to as intelligence. And intelligence for the alcoholic is the ability to say no when them drinks come around. So what a lot of work it takes to get to that point, to get smart enough in here to say no. And they listened to me. And they loved me. And when I wasn't up front talking to them and telling them how it was, I was drunk. Now, I was a student of the big book. I want you to know that. Every alcoholic's got a song that he listens to, right? Every alcoholic. Some of you like country and western. Some of you jazz. My song was a song by the Four Freshmen. And they sang it a cappella. And it was a song called Their Hearts Were Full of Spring. And God, it was sad. There's a story told of a very special boy and a girl who wore his ring. Through the wintry snow, their love remained still warm, for their hearts were full of spring. And man, the tears was running by then. And then you get to the chorus, then one day they die. And their graves were side by side on a hill where robins sing. And they say violets grow there the whole year round because their hearts were full of spring. Oh, God. And before it was over good, I started it again. And I'd listen to the Four Freshmen and drink and study the big book. That's an old beat-up book, and on the front of that book are circles. Those are circles from whiskey glasses and beer cans while I was imbibing and studying the big book. 7 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, the longest I ever stayed sober was 89 days. And I knew it all. 89 days. And I know it was 89 days. Because in North Carolina, we give out poker chips for varying lengths of sobriety. And we gave a red poker chip for 3 months. And I got a calendar. And on the 90th day, I pasted that red chip. And I'd come home every day and I'd X off another day and go to bed real quick before I could get drunk. I was going to get them 3 months. And you know I X'd off days for 89 days, and on the 90th day, I rested. You want to know what a god-awful feeling is? A god-awful feeling is knowing you got the answer in your hand. Knowing that the answer is as close as that switch on the wall and you're reaching for it with all of your heart and your soul and your might and you can't reach it. God, it's unreal. I wasn't trying not to be sober. I was trying to be sober. I was sick of being sick. I was sick of being different, and I couldn't even be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. Even there, I was different. And I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous at a different place at a later time. And I got to tell you about this place. They'll meet tomorrow night up in Burlington, North Carolina, and it's one of those AA groups where everyone has a seat. Do you know what I mean? You don't dare take somebody's seat. Now, if you go to Burlington, North Carolina tomorrow night, you look on the left-hand side of the room, leaning against the wall, will be a guy named Barney. And next to him will be Jim S. And right behind Jim sat Martha. She's dead now, but there's still nobody sits in her seat. And they're screaming and they're wimpy, and I could go around the room and tell you who will be there. And over on the right-hand side, the second row, the second chair from the wall, sat the meanest man that God ever made. His name was Bill C., and I called him Grumpy, and I hated his guts. You know why I hated his guts? Because he always told me the truth. Unerringly. Unsparingly, too, he always told me the truth. Boy, how come you always run around looking for God? He ain't lost. And boy, you don't think your way into good living. You live your way into good thinking. I think to myself, shut up, old man. I'm smarter than you are. And every Tuesday night at discussion meeting, Grumpy would sit up there, and he'd rattle his change and pull his nose, and damn, he had an ugly nose, and he'd pull that nose, looked like a pickle, and he'd pull it, and run his hand through his hair, and then he'd rattle his chain, pull his nose, and run his hand through his hair, say the same thing every Tuesday night. I knew how smart than he was. Only thing I couldn't do was stay sober. Now, Grumpy's been sober 29 years now. 29 years! And if you've tried this program and nothing else works for you, may I suggest you rattle your chains and pull your nose and run your hand through your hair. But I talked to Grumpy not long ago. He's retired now, and I called him up. He said, boy, how long you been sober now? I told him. It was a long silence. He said, Tom, you know something? He said, I used to figure every drunk had a chance in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then you came along. And you know, I'd sit out in my den out at the college in the Buddhist position, reading The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis and The Confessions of St. Augustine, I and Thou by Martin Buber, Paul Tillich's Courage to Be, Plato's Dialogue, Little Aristotle, Little Kant, looking for God, seriously looking for God, because I knew these men had found him, and I knew somehow down deep it was the only answer for me. What I didn't think about was each of these men found a God of his own understanding. And I'd sit there in the Buddhist position waiting for my spiritual awakening to happen. I figured if God could knock the Apostle Paul off a jackass and light up a bush for Moses, he could give me one damn lightning bolt. And God just never understood me. God probably knew if he sent the lightning bolt through the window and hit me with it, I wouldn't have liked the color. You know, I go to AA meetings. I had to impress these people. I had to get those pats on the back for them to tell me I was all right. I didn't like them seeing through me to where I really live. And Grumpy saw right into me. Grumpy said, boy, the good Lord gave you two ears and one mouth. Does that mean a damn thing to you? Things like that that hurt me. And I had to get their approval. So I'd go to meetings. And I went to meetings with some of the heaviest knowledge you have ever heard in your life. You ever go to an AA meeting with such heavy knowledge that your knuckles were white waiting your turn to come in that discussion meeting so you could just wow them? Don't lie. It's all right. If you've ever been to an AA discussion meeting, you've been to a session of Can You Top This? You know it and I know it. And I'd fall in there on the back row with that heavy knowledge. And everybody'd speak their piece. They always got to me last. It was like the meeting was over when they got to me. And it was. And I'd say, Paul Tillich said so-and-so, and Martin Buber said so-and-so, and Grumpy turn around and say, shut up, dummy. You know, I always look for an answer outside myself. I went to the places where other people found answers, easily found answers. I went to the psychiatrist in all seriousness. And the psychiatrist said to me, you know, in a group, it seems you got to know about yourself. And I started studying me. To the point where one psychiatrist told me one time, Tom, I've never met a man in my entire practice who knew himself as well as you do. Why do you drink? And I stood there and cried like a baby. I said, man, you're supposed to tell me that. I don't know. And I went to religion. In between every two drunks, I went back to the Baptist church. I wore fur down the aisle of the Baptist church. Every time they sing Just As I Am, boom, I hit that aisle. Almost Persuaded, boom, I'd hit that aisle. And I'll tell you something, I meant it every single time. When an alcoholic tells you he doesn't want to drink again, he means it. When the alcoholic goes down the aisle in the church and rededicates himself, he means it. When he makes his promises and his resolutions, he means them. But what he doesn't know at the time is he doesn't have the power to carry them off. And religion said, hey, you got to get good. So I did. I taught Sunday school in a mission in the poorest part of town. I led the singing. I did the preaching. I did it all. Good work. And I drank. I drank. I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that all the prayer, meditation, good work, and faith in the world don't mean nothing until I remove the things in myself that are blocking me from God Almighty Himself. You've heard faith without works is dead. Works without faith is just as dead. And I'm convinced today there's a step beyond faith and works, and it's called trust. And I trust my God. I drive my wife up the tree sometime. A big bill comes in. I got no money in the bank. And I say, honey, God's taken care of us for a long time. Something will turn up. How can you say that? I say, from experience. See, she thinks I know something that she doesn't know, and I don't. I just believe it's going to happen. And it always does. We haven't wanted for a thing since I got sober. And we got the good things of life. But let me get back. I drank on. I drank on until I was 30 years old, until I'd lost my driver's license so many times that I was on 5 years probation with a 2-year active road sentence hanging over my head. I was never supposed to drive again as long as I lived. I drove under a tractor trailer one night in a drunken blackout. Put myself in traction for 3.5 months, crushed my left leg, my left arm, ripped my face off again. And while I was in traction for 3.5 months, I became addicted to morphine. and I withdrew from morphine in traction. When he took me off the morphine, he put me on codeine, then the Pantapon, then he put me on a harmless medication, which had just then come out, called Percodan. And when I took my first Percodan, I knew it wasn't a harmless medication. And I sat around, I couldn't walk, and I sat around for the next 5 months and took Percodan and Seconal and drank Pepsi-Cola. Because I found out the caffeine in the Pepsi-Cola would jack up the drug. Now, as long as I sat in my chair, I felt fine. I felt great. There was that sense of freedom. When I got up, I puked. Wasn't the answer. And I drank off. Somewhere around age 30, I hit bottom. And I'll never forget that either. All the stops were out. The con game was over. I couldn't con me. I couldn't con you. I couldn't lie to you. I couldn't lie to me. The rationalizations were gone. School was out. I was dead, and I knew it. And I'll tell you tonight, that is the most blessed point I have ever come to in my entire life. Because to me, the gateway and the only gateway to the world of the spirit is bottom. Because only at bottom, when all of my choices were gone, was I willing to surrender. And surrender is an invitation to God. And God's very polite, the God that I understand. He interferes not in my life except by invitation. And when I hit that bottom and I cried out, I give up. Man, he came in like air into a vacuum. Zoop! The gateway to that world of the spirit. And I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm going to tell you, I didn't think it would work for me. I was convinced I was different. I'd look at the fifth chapter and I'd read about those with grave emotional and mental disorders, and I was one of those. And I believed it, but I went. And I'd sit on the back row and I'd get there late and I'd leave early. But I kept going. I kept going. And finally I noticed this one man in the group, and this man had good eyes. You want to watch an alcoholic sober up, watch his eyes. Watch him as the red begins to disappear. Watch him as they begin to clear up a little bit. Watch him as he begins to watch you. See the clarity, the clearness. He is seeing beyond sight for the first time in his life. It's God peeking out. And it's beautiful. And this man had good eyes. And that's all I can tell you. And I said, "Harry, will you sponsor me?" And you know what he said? He said, "Boy, I've heard about you. They tell me you're crazy. But yes, I'll sponsor you on one condition, Tom." I said, "What's that?" He said, "We do it my way." I said, "Oh, what's your way?" He said, "It's in this book." I said, "Well, that's good. I know that book." He said, "No, you don't." He said, "The spiritual life's not like other things, Tom. You don't understand the spiritual life and then do it. You do it, and then you might understand it. It's totally opposite from anything you know. Don't tell me you know anything about the program. You don't." And he said, "First thing I want you to do is start going to meetings early. I want you to go in and shake everybody's hand and ask them how they're doing." I said, "Harry, I don't want to go to those meetings early. And I don't want to shake anybody's hand, and I don't give a damn how they're doing. And why do I have to do that, Harry?" He says, "You don't ask me why, you do it." And I do it. And you know, I'd go in that group and I'd get there early and I'd go over and shake hands. As an alcoholic, I don't know about you, I never looked at anybody. I looked over there and down there, up there, you know. I looked at a lot of shoe tops in my life. And that's what I was doing. I'd go in and mumble, you know, good to see him. And look at shoe tops. And after a few weeks, I was seeing some ankles. And then some shins and some knees and some hips. Saw some nice hips. And then waist and chest and finally the magic. And this is the magic of the Alcoholics Anonymous program. It might seem trite to some people, but to us it doesn't. the magic of looking somebody right in the eyes, and I was glad to see him, and I did care how he was doing. Now, my sponsor didn't preach to me about love. My sponsor taught me how to do love. My sponsor taught me love's not a feeling or a thought. Feelings and thoughts come and go. Love stays. Feeling's an action. What's more, feeling is God's action to his children, through his children, to his other children, back to God, the endless circle, world without end. Huh? And I began to know all these things. And I got there early, man. I put out the coffee cups and the ashtrays, made the coffee, cleaned up the ashtrays, washed the coffee cups, cleaned out the coffee maker, put it back. Nobody was going to beat me at washing coffee cups. Did you hear me? Weakness to strength. Weakness to strength. See, I don't believe God says when one of us messes comes to the door of Alcoholics Anonymous, hey, mess, get on out there and get straightened up and then come back. Now, the people of AA who speak for God say, come on in, mess. We want you and we love you just like you are. You belong here. It's fantastic. You know, when I picked up my 90-day chip, you would have thought I'd been sober 35 years. The place went crazy. And do you know, I hadn't even thought about it. I didn't think about it. I, who had always looked for big things, am sitting down at the college one day eating a sandwich in my office. And here's the way it came, like a thought banging into my mind. And you know what the thought said? Hey, you haven't wanted a drink for over 3 months. And I cried like a baby. And I went to my first aid convention. And people all over North Carolina had bet my sponsor I'd never stay sober. That's the truth. They took bets on me. And I was sober a year, and I was happy, and I was feeling good. And I was sitting back there while listening to this lady talk, you know, the old Baptist, and I hated everything Baptist. And she's up front talking. I guess she was making a good talk. I'm sitting back in the corner on the back row singing, Love Lifted Me. I go to another retreat, you know, and I go into the little chapel, and there's a stained glass window up behind the pulpit. And it's a picture of the carpenter. And I notice something right away. There's no cross, you know? And this thought comes banging into my mind again. Where's the cross? Where's the cross? And the second thought, it's been removed, Tom. And so has yours. And I cried like a baby. Ah, the intellectual who get out in the backyard with my little boy and roll around in the grass in circles. That's not very intellectual. We roll around out there one day in the grass. His name is Jason. He's absolutely beautiful. We're rolling around in the grass, and Jason rolls in and stops, or I do, and he's still rolling around. And I took a little stick and put it in the ground. And I took a leaf, and I put on the stick. And I took another leaf, and I put on the stick. And he's rolling in smaller circles. And finally, he rolls into a stop. He says, hey, Dad, let's build a tree. And we did. And I cried like a baby. Spiritual experience. And I went into my house, and I was walking that high off the floor, I guess. My wife said, what in the world is the matter with you? I said, man, me and Jason just built a tree. She said, Joyce Kilmer said only God could make a tree. I said, he'll have to rewrite that poem. We just did it. Now, I listen to my children. I adore my children. And what's more, they adore me. My 18-year-old brings all her friends over to the house to see the fox. And I love it. I love it. My little boy, Jason, we were working together not long ago, and I was kind of uptight, and I said, Jace, sometimes it's awful hard to be a good daddy. And immediately he patted me on the back and says, Dad, it just seems to come easy to you. And my little daughter, Frances, who is named after an AA lady, gave me this. It's a heart. And it says, and I quote, Dear Dad, I love you more than my teddy bear. Love, Frances.
Beat it!
If you can. There is meaning in my life and there is purpose. And I found it not outside myself. I found it inside myself. And I found out in Alcoholics Anonymous that all you need to find the beauty that's inside of you, which I believe is God Himself, is you need a kit of spiritual tools, and that we are provided. And you need people who have found that answer to guide you, and that has been provided. And you need action, and action, and action, and more action. And you'll find it. You will find it. It's there. It's always been there. It's like a friend of mine says, you don't find God because God is too close to find. It's like the carpenter said, don't look for the kingdom of heaven on the mountain or in Jerusalem or in Samaria or anywhere else. The kingdom of heaven's right in the middle of you. Strange. Now, Jace is 10 now, but when he was about 4 years old or younger and he was on his potty chair, you've heard of armchair philosophers, he was a potty chair philosopher. And when he sat on his potty, one of us had to go in and sit with him, you know, and listen to him. He liked to talk. And I got the job one night, you know, and I'm sitting there with Jace, and I listen to my children. Oh, God, I listen to all children. They got it. They haven't been grabbed up by this ego world yet. They still think it's a wee place to live. And they're related to everything, even rocks or leaves. If you don't believe me, watch them. Love's automatic. They're born with it. So are we. Anyway, I'm sitting there with Jason. He looks up, and right out of the clear blue, he says, Dad, Jesus turns the power on. Now, I am not here to sell you Jesus. That's not my job, see? But this is what this kid said. And I was astounded. And I said, well, son, how do you know that? Did your mother tell you that? No, sir. Well, did you learn that in Sunday school? No, sir. Well, how do you know such a thing? He said, it's simple. I just know. That's why. Now, listen to me. Why is it? When every man, woman, and child gets in trouble and the stops are out and the con games are not working and they know they're going to die, why is it that every one of them, alcoholic or not, will say the equivalent of three words? God help me. Why? I believe it's because we know. We know. I believe because there's a part of us that knows, that always prays, and that cries out to the Father in times of stress. I didn't have to think when I asked God to help me, did you? It just came flying out. The big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, says deep down inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. That's what I'm talking about. It's there, and it's always been there. I'm sitting there with Jace a little while later. One night we're sitting on the couch, and he looks up at me and says, Dad, why don't I be the dad for a while and you be the son? I said, well, hey, how are we going to work that? Stock answer for him is, it's simple. I'll grow up and be the father. You grow down and be the son. All right? I submit to you that the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous is indeed a process of growing down to be a child of God. The book Alcoholics Anonymous says if you want to make it, first of all, we had to quit playing God. Hereafter in this drama of life, he's the director. He's the principal, we're his agents, he's the father, and we're his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this simple concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. It's in the book. The same thing I'd found in the King Cotton Hotel at 15 in a brown bottle marked Cream of Kentucky. Freedom was available to me in this program, only it was different. It was not illusionary. It was real. It was not temporary. It is lasting. And thank God for it. Now, I'm still a perfectionist. And look at a crew. still a romantic. I love beautiful music. I love beautiful art. I can smell. I can see. I can taste. I can feel. I'm still very sensitive. Thank God for it. I can listen to a new person and I can cry for him if I need to. I'm still an intellectual. And it has held me in good stead in this program because I'm still a student of the big book, only this time without the four freshmen and without the booze. I am all the things that I was when I walked through that door, and yet I am inalterably changed. Why? See, that's the question, why? Can you answer me logically why? There's no logical reason. It goes far beyond logic. Far beyond. I didn't make it that way, it just does. I no longer think I can, and I must, and I will do things my way in this world. Because I realized when I hit bottom that the one ingredient that was lacking in my life more than anything else was a lack of power. A lack of power. Now what's happened? Same equipment. Nothing new has been added to me. Let me tell you this way. You've heard this thing 100 times, but listen to it. It was battered and worn, and the auctioneer thought it scarcely worth his while to waste much time on the old violin. But he held it up with a smile. What am I bidding, good folk, he cried. Who'll start the bidding for me? $1? $1, and who'll make it two? $2, and who'll make it three? $3 once, $3 twice, going for three? But no. From the back of the room, a gray-haired man came forward and picked up the bow. And wiping the dust from the old violin and tightening up all the strings, he played a melody soft and sweet as an angel sings. And the music ceased, and the auctioneer, in a voice now soft and low, said, what am I bid for this old violin? And he held it up with the bow. $1,000, and who'll make it two? $2,000, and who'll make it three? $3,000 once, $3,000 twice, and going, and gone, said he, and the people cheered. But some of them said, we just don't understand. What changed its worth? And the man replied, the touch of the master's. And many a person with life out of tune and battered and torn within is auctioned cheap to a thoughtless crowd, much like the old violin. A mess of pottage, a glass of wine, a game, and they travel on. They're going once, they're going twice, they're gone, and almost gone. But the master comes. And the foolish crowd will never quite understand the worth of a soul and the change that's wrought by the touch of the master's hand. See, I owe you. I owe you, Janet, and I owe you, Lynn, and I owe you, Keith, and I owe all the rest of you people here. I didn't tighten up my strings. I didn't dust me off. And it is not I who is playing the melody. You did it, and I owe you. And I'll never repay the debt, and that's good. Because it keeps me humping. And I love you for it. I love you more than love, more than any love I ever understood. Because you've helped give me the greatest thing that any man could ever have, this freedom. And I hope I never forget where it came from. That's why I go to meetings. That's why I'm active in sponsorship. That's why I travel all over this country. That's why I go to my home group every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night if I'm in town, and a couple other groups. That's why when I'm 30 years sober, I'll still be going to 5 meetings a week, God willing, because I owe you a debt that can never be paid. When I was a drunken gospel singer, we used to sing a song, and the chorus of the song said, he touched me. Yes, he touched me. And oh, what joy now fills my soul.
something happened. And now I know he touched me and made me whole. And I want to thank you for helping me to be free and helping me to be me. On January the 9th of this year, the finest man that I've ever known in this world, my own earthly father, passed away. When I was 18 years old, I joined the Air Force, and he couldn't shove me on that bus quick enough to get me out of town. But on his deathbed, he rolled over and he said, "Tommy, I love you. You're a fine man." My father was quiet, gentle, kind, loving person. And by the grace of God, through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, what you see before you tonight is a kind, gentle, loving person. And you get the credit. And I thank you.